In addition to moves by congressional Republicans to repeal the big health care law, there are challenges to it coming up through the courts. And the lawsuit that many observers think has the strongest chance of success is one brought by 26 states, the National Federation of Independent Business, and two individuals. The names and stories of those two individuals may soon become common knowledge if their lawsuit goes to the Supreme Court and either upends or confirms the mandate to buy health insurance. But for now, the two, Kai Ahlberg of Port Angeles, Washington, and Mary Brown of Panama City, Florida, are reluctant to be interviewed. We've tried unsuccessfully to have them speak on the program. And journalist Harris Meyer, who's based in Yakima, Washington, has also tried, and he joins us now. Any luck?
Robert, I called both of them last June when I was doing a story on this, and I've tried several times as recently as yesterday to reach them. Kai Ahlberg, who's very voluble and outspoken on every other issue, has failed to return my messages. Mary Brown, I spoke to briefly, including yesterday. She spent nearly 10 minutes telling me that she's too busy to talk to me.
Well, these are two citizens who say that they cannot be or should not be forced to buy health insurance by the year 2014. I'd like you to tell us a bit about them. First, about Ms. Brown.
Mary Brown owns a small auto repair shop in a low-income section of Panama City in the Florida Panhandle. She apparently has no health insurance. She told me she does not provide it for her employees. Her children are grown. She did not say whether she provided it for them, but she says that she needs the, in the lawsuit, needs the resources to run her business and doesn't want to put it into health insurance.
And Kai Ahlberg?
Kai Ahlberg is a apparently wealthy, retired Harvard-educated lawyer and Wall Street investment banker who moved out to Port Angeles several years ago. He says that he doesn't want to have health insurance. He can pay for health care out of pocket.
And what would the big health care law, how would it affect these two people? I'd like to get a sense of what it would do to them and what their complaint is, actually.
Well, Mary Brown is a small business owner, and under the law, she would qualify for significant subsidies to buy insurance for herself and her employees. She would not fall under the employer mandate to provide it. It would be up to her, but she and her employees all would be obligated to personally acquire health insurance one way or another. I should say that both of these individuals are around 50 years old. Kai Ahlberg is an individual. He's not running any business, and he would be obligated to buy health insurance, which he refuses to do or he doesn't want to do because he says he's able to pay for it out of pocket and he doesn't want to be required.
Let's say that the law were to take effect, that this lawsuit were not to prevail, and these individuals refused to buy health insurance. What would happen to them under the health care law?
They would face a tax penalty starting in 2015 of about $700, which would be enforced by the Internal Revenue Service for failure to buy health insurance.
This particular suit is different from other challenges in that there are these two citizens. The suit originated in Florida, but they are suing as individuals. And in the district court hearing where it was agreed that they have standing to sue, I gather they had a rather sympathetic judge on the bench.
Yes, Judge Roger Vinson, appointed by President Reagan in the 80s, made comments that indicated he was quite sympathetic to the state's case. He said that he did not have health insurance when his son was born, and he paid out of pocket, and he doesn't see why people should be required to do so. And he equated this requirement to the government requiring people to join a gym or eat broccoli. And most people are expecting that he will rule in favor of the states and strike down the constitutionality of the individual mandate provision.
Well, Harris Meyer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, let's do it again, Robert.
Okay, Mr. Meyer is a journalist and blogger based in Yakima, Washington. He was talking about the challenge springing from the state of Florida against the health care law and the two individuals who were plaintiffs in that action. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In Florida, fallout from the housing collapse continues to reverberate through even seemingly unrelated parts of the economy. In the last few years, landowners have given up on more than 100,000 acres of citrus groves. Florida is a national leader in orange and grapefruit production, and NPR's Greg Allen reports that the abandoned groves have become a threat to producers of the state's signature crop.
Indian River on Florida's Atlantic coast is known for its world-class grapefruit, oranges, and tangelos. If you've ever received a fruit basket from the Sunshine State, it likely came from here. This time of year, many trees are still heavy with fruit. There are also many groves that aren't doing so well.
This is a grove in Vero Beach. It's a commercial grove, 140 acres. You can see there's still little bits and pieces of fruit in the trees, but for the most part, this grove is dead.
Phil Strazula knows Indian River citrus. He grew up in the industry, but now is mostly in the real estate business, buying and selling agricultural acreage in the heart of Florida's citrus belt. He's behind the wheel in his pickup, showing me one of Indian River's many abandoned groves. Strazula's concern is not for the abandoned grove, but for a healthy and productive grapefruit and tangelo producer just next door.
This is a commercial grove still, but it's starting to decline. You'll start seeing a few missing tree spaces. You'll start seeing trees that are going down. And this is a direct result of the disease pressure from that dead grove across the ditch.
Some blocks of trees are almost dead. Some have already been pulled up. Other rows still appear healthy. Strazula pulls his pickup over close to a tree and pulls off a piece of fruit that's nearly as large as a softball.
This is a honeybell orange. This is probably one of the best eating, best marketing oranges, the highest dollar volume, highest return to a grower. So losing this block for this grower will be painful.
Citrus growers have always had to fight disease, but in recent years here in Florida, it seems that disease is getting the upper hand. Most recently, two, canker and citrus greening, have been very difficult to control, requiring more care and nearly constant spraying for pests. Those diseases help push many producers out of citrus. But Christine Kelly Bagazzo says there's another compelling factor: falling land prices. She's an agriculture extension agent with the University of Florida in Indian River County. Kelly Bagazzo says during the housing boom, speculators paid top dollar for citrus groves.
Now, if you bought acreage at that time, speculating that you were going to be able to make some money off of agriculture development or whatever, and then the development boom busted, there's no incentive now. And that acreage is actually costing you money now. So they've abandoned the groves, but they're not building on them either.
How beautiful.
Yeah.
These are flame grapefruit. Got a beautiful color.
That is.
Bob Adair is a citrus researcher. We're in the middle of his small grove in Vero Beach doing some tasting.
Now this is going to be a little bit acid. Juicy, huh?
Yeah.
Got juice on the microphone.
Adair is working with USDA and the University of Florida looking for better ways to control the ever-growing list of citrus diseases. At the top currently is greening disease. It's spread by a tiny insect called a psyllid. Adair says in his grove it's infected nearly a third of all his trees. On a tangelo tree, he lifts a branch that's beginning to show the effects.
This is the feeding damage caused by the psyllid. We call those notched leaves. The other symptoms that you see here are these very, very small leaves.
Even with treatment, this tree's days are numbered. It's a big problem even for careful and proactive growers like Adair. Fungus and insects from infected trees quickly migrate to healthy groves nearby. And the growing number of abandoned groves makes the problem harder to control. Citrus producers in Indian River have begun a program to bulldoze and burn trees in abandoned groves. But it's costly and depends on the cooperation of sometimes absentee owners. It's the latest of many challenges for an industry that's long grown one of Florida's most lucrative crops. Adair says the last 3 decades have presented citrus growers with one new disease after another. The reason, he says, is globalization.
What we did was we very efficiently took citrus from another hemisphere, brought it into the United States, into Florida, and grew it as an exotic species. We took it away from its natural enemies. And what we're seeing right now is all the natural enemies of citrus have found it here in Florida.
Adair says he believes given enough time and research, the industry will find a way to effectively control greening and canker. He estimates, though, that may take up to a decade, and many in the industry may not be able to wait that long. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Vatican is trying to downplay a letter that seems to warn Irish bishops not to report sex abuse cases to authorities. The Vatican says the 14-year-old letter does not instruct Irish bishops to disregard civil law, but lawyers in the U.S. say it shows the Vatican was responsible for sheltering abusive priests. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
In 1996, Catholic bishops in Ireland decided they would begin working with police to help identify pedophile priests. A year later, the Vatican panel wrote back with its assessment of the policy. The Congregation for the Clergy said that the proposed policy might violate the Church's canon law. The results could be highly embarrassing and detrimental, it said, adding, "The situation of mandatory reporting gives rise to serious reservations of both a moral and canonical nature." Plaintiff's attorney Jeffrey Anderson is suing the Vatican, something no one has done successfully before, on behalf of an American molested by a priest. He calls the letter a smoking gun.
This letter is a stunning piece of evidence that the Vatican has control. It demands secrecy, and it fails to protect the kids, as it did our client.
Anderson is trying to prove that the priest was an employee of the Vatican, and therefore the Vatican is accountable. He says the 1997 letter and other documents showed the buck stops with the Pope.
There is but one entity and one man that is in control of all matters pertaining to sexual abuse and the movement of priests, and that is the Holy See, the Pope.
It's not a smoking gun.
Nick Cafardi is a canon lawyer at Duquesne University Law School. He says the letter to the Irish bishops is bathed in hypotheticals, problems that could arise if the bishops turned over cases to the police.
It doesn't say you can't do this. It says it might be problematical. If I'm an Irish bishop and I get a letter like this, I think, well, okay, that's their opinion.
Jeffrey Lena, an attorney for the Vatican in the U.S., agrees. In a statement, he says, nowhere does the letter tell Irish bishops to ignore requirements to report crimes. Rather, he says, the Vatican was only warning Irish bishops that if they didn't follow church law precisely, a Vatican court could overturn a decision to defrock an abusive priest. However you interpret the Irish letter, it's unclear whether it will help any lawsuit in the United States, says Joe Della Pina, a law professor at Villanova University.
If it can be shown that it applied in the United States, it would, I think, be very damaging.
But for it to be relevant in U.S. courts, he says, you have to show that the letter was intended to apply to U.S. bishops or that U.S. bishops received a similar warning.
If you could show other evidence of Vatican involvement in the United States, then maybe the Irish letter might reinforce an inference. But by itself, it doesn't prove very much about the United States.
The bigger problem, lawyers say, is that it is enormously difficult to sue the Vatican, because under U.S. law, the Vatican is considered a sovereign state, like Italy or France, and U.S. courts are almost always unwilling to reach into affairs of foreign states. Still, the letter has given a boost to plaintiffs' attorneys who want to use the letter to draw a direct line between sexual abusers in the U.S. and the Vatican. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
For many Americans, a motorcycle trip on the open road is a delicious fantasy. For writer Jonathan Bastian, it became a reality. But no road trip on two wheels is complete without a little relevant reading material. So he has these recommendations as part of our series Three Books, where writers recommend three books on one theme.
I had no more excuses. Sitting in my driveway was an old motorcycle that still ran well but was beginning to rust away. For years, I dreamed of taking my Motorcycle Diaries trip, which definitely included the part about exploring South America, having some steamy love affairs, maybe even starting my own Che Guevara-inspired revolution. But dreams are still dreams, and the idea of driving a motorcycle from my home in Colorado to Argentina seemed, sadly, impossible with my domesticated trappings. But a trip through Wyoming and Montana for 2 weeks? That seemed doable. So I took some time off work, bought a few maps, and found three books that were perfect for the trip. Driving through Wyoming, I started with a novel called The Meadow by James Galvin, who describes a punishing stretch of ranch land where men still snap ribs on cattle drives, and where the winters are so long and the silence is so heavy that people lose track of days and sometimes their sanity. Because Galvin is primarily a poet, he's not interested in riveting plot lines, but moments, images, crystalline reflections of characters who sometimes die because they're too scared to ask for help in a community that prides itself on self-reliance. From Wyoming, I crossed into Montana, the rugged territory of Jim Harrison, whose iconic novels include Legends of the Fall and Dalva. But like James Galvin, Harrison is also a poet. His most recent collection of poems, called In Search of Small Gods, captures Harrison's love for both Buddhism and the outdoors, contrasting moments of inner calm with the primal brutality of the Western wilderness. In fact, many of these poems unfold like simple fables, leaving you with the sense that you've just learned something, even though you're not sure what. But look, I realize that a motorcycle trip is also supposed to be a manly adventure of oil and engines and whiskey and troublemaking, so I brought along Hell's Angels by Hunter S. Thompson. This is the ultimate biker book that recounts the author's adventures riding with the infamous Hell's Angels motorcycle gang as they brawled, boozed, and tore through small towns like Vikings. But in the end, Thompson reveals that they were still regular guys whose toxic reputations commonly broke apart their families, their jobs, and sometimes their entire lives. Most famous for his novel, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, it's rumored that Thompson wrote the last half of Hell's Angels in 48 hours with a bottle of Wild Turkey bourbon and other illicit substances. That story inspired me so much that I hid away my book of poetry and ventured into a dingy biker bar. I quickly realized that my week-old patchy beard and Patagonia raincoat looked pathetically lame next to my leather-coated, tattooed brethren. Needless to say, I returned home to Colorado a humbled man. So for those of you who've always dreamed of taking a similar adventure, you've got no more excuses. Because I've already solved the hardest problem of taking this trip, or for that matter, any trip. It isn't figuring out where you'll go or how you'll get the bike, but deciding on what books you'll bring.
Jonathan Bastian is a literary contributor at Aspen Public Radio. You can catch up on more Three Books recommendations at our website, npr.org.
Get your motor running. And whatever comes our way.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
When President Obama welcomed President Hu Jintao to the White House today, he had some company. Students from Washington, D.C.'s Yuying Elementary School were part of the greeting party. It's the district's first Chinese language immersion school. And as NPR's Brett Neely reports, it's a sign of how much interest there is across the country in learning Chinese.
A sign above the door of this classroom says, if you have to speak English, whisper. And learning the ABCs is not on the lesson plan for these pre-kindergartners this morning.
I think it's a poem, and it looks like a kid's poem. They actually know more than I do. I know a little bit of Chinese, enough to be dangerous, but they're actually better than me.
Yu Ying's executive director, Mary Schaffner, showed me around.
You know, it's amazing. They've only been in school. These four-year-olds have only been in school since the beginning of the year, and you saw them read all those characters.
Yu Ying is a public charter school. The name means nurturing excellence. It doesn't charge any fees, though parents do have to apply to send their kids there. The school opened its doors 3 years ago and now has 240 students from pre-K to third grade and plans to expand to the eighth grade. The student body is about half African American and a quarter white. Most of the rest of the students are Asian. Many come from families where English is the first language. The kids spend every other school day immersed in Chinese, taught by native speakers. Schaffner, whose daughter is in the first grade here, helped found the school with a group of parents.
We all knew Chinese was the language of the future, and what an edge to give our children.
Frank Lowenstein's daughter is a first grader.
I had a slightly different motivation with the amount of money we currently owe the Chinese. I figured it couldn't hurt to have a daughter who spoke Chinese when they come around to collect.
And it's that sense of China's growing importance to the U.S. that's driving a boom in Chinese education across all levels. In 2007, the College Board started offering Chinese advanced placement exams for high school students. By last year, the number of students taking those exams doubled to nearly 5,000. 60,000 college students studied Chinese in 2009, twice the number a decade ago. Still, Spanish remains by far the most commonly taught foreign language in American classrooms. At the college level, Chinese continues to lag behind a number of languages, including French and German. But many students now see Chinese as vital to their careers. Joshua Sloan is a freshman at George Washington University who plans to major in business and minor in Chinese. He was inspired by his dad, who works for Costco and travels regularly to China.
He doesn't speak the language. And while he does a great job and he's very good at dealing with people, it would give him that much more of an edge if he spoke Chinese.
Sloan started learning Chinese at his high school in Seattle. Hundreds of high schools across the country have added Chinese to their curriculum, sometimes at the expense of other languages. Some of those schools are getting financial help from the Confucius Institute, an organization backed by the Chinese government. But interest in languages does follow fads, says Jonathan Chaves, a professor of Chinese at George Washington. Up until the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre, enrollment in his department had been steadily climbing.
They went right off the cliff after Tiananmen and stayed down for a long period of time and only started coming back, tracking the news about China, getting better.
If the political or economic climate changes, he says students may again lose interest in Chinese. But meanwhile, Chaves says this generation of students entering college is already much better prepared to learn Chinese than students were 10 years ago. And the students at the Yuying School, who've been learning Chinese since they were four, will be even better prepared. Brett Neely, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.